Welcome to Contemplative Revolution, a WCCM podcast from Bonnevaux, a center for peace. I am Elba Rodriguez. In this episode, Professor David Tacy reflects on the divide between religion and spirituality and the kind of religion that will meet the needs of the postmodern and post-secular era. This talk was part of a John Main seminar in Hamilton, New Zealand. David Tacy is an interdisciplinary scholar and public intellectual.
We live in a period of history in which public opinion is privileging spirituality above religion, and where the latter, religion, is regarded with a good deal of suspicion. Religion, as the term is used in popular discourse, not scholarly but popular, refers to traditional and conventional practices of based on creeds, doctrines, and rituals. And with modernity and fashion weighted heavily against tradition and skeptical of belief in any form, the term religion has come to carry negative connotations in today's society. Excuse me. Spirituality, as the term is used, refers to the personal pursuit of the sacred, often expressed in unconventional ways. And in an individualistic society like ours, this carries positive connotations. If religion is viewed as burdensome and extraneous by some, spirituality is constructed as experiential and life-affirming. Now, spirituality in the West is influenced, of course, by Eastern philosophies, and the turn to the East is forcing spirituality and religion even further apart. I sometimes imagine spirituality and religion as separating continents, which were once fused, a bit like Gondwana land or something. Yeah. They were all connected, all the continents. And gradually there was a rupture, tectonic schism, and religion and spirituality, alas, appear in modern Western societies to be drifting apart on a continental, on the ocean. And the foundations of culture have been shaken. Indeed, that's the name of one of Paul Tillich's great books, The Shaking of the Foundations. And this indicates that the West is in crisis and things are adrift. And the continental drift has impacted on religious institutions, of course, causing them to lose much public authority and bringing some to the point of near collapse. But along with this, the psychological and the social functions of the West have been disturbed. We are clearly at a point of the changing of the gods, as it used to be called in ancient times, at the end of one era and the beginning of another, but we don't yet know what the future will look like. There are, of course, utopian and dystopian imaginings of our religious future. Now, as you know, the construction of spirituality and religion as opposites is anomalous from an historical point of view. Spirituality once referred, and I'm old enough to remember this, the living core of religion and the capacity to appropriate religion in a direct and personal way. I recall from my childhood that those who attended weekly services were often referred to as religious, but those who wanted to take religion a step further and establish a personal and intimate relationship with God was said to be spiritual. This sense of spirituality, of course, is still found in the orders and in monastic contexts where we find such things as Jesuit, Benedictine, or Carmelite spiritualities, for instance. But this ecclesiastical use of the term spirituality is now somewhat minor compared with the vast numbers who appropriate spirituality in a different way. In the public arena, spirituality has little or nothing to do with religion and refers to all forms of activity that concern the search for meaning. One of my guides on this topic is the very wonderful religious sister from San Francisco, Sandra Snyders, who's one of the world experts on spirituality. I had the good fortune to meet her last year. She says, she's a sort of hard-hitting writer. She tells it as it is. She says, quote, "We have to recognize the linguistic fact that neither religion in general nor Christianity in particular any longer controls the meaning and the use of the term spirituality." And that's from her fascinating lecture, which you can get on the internet if you're interested. Religion and spirituality, are they strangers, rivals, or partners? What a brilliant heading that is. The Santa Clara lectures from California. Now, religious people often complain, perhaps rightly, that spirituality has been hijacked by the secular. And this may be the case, but it's now an historical fact and can't be denied. Recently, the idea of secular spirituality has emerged, a term which would have been seen as contradictory, almost, it's an oxymoron, say, a couple of generations or more ago. Peter Van Ness has written this interesting book called Spirituality and the Secular Quest, which helps us, I think, understand cultures like Britain and Australia and New Zealand and France, and cultures that are perhaps officially religious but basically extremely secular. It was interesting last night to her. The Anglican bishop said, what's her name? Helen Ann, yes, she said, our apparently secular society. Yeah. And then the Catholic bishop got up and said, our very secular society. I don't know quite what that tells us about their respective traditions, but I think both of them are right. It is apparently secular, but it's also very secular. Now, historical forces have brought about this rift between religion and spirituality, and I'll identify two of these: secularisation and, of course, the rise of science. Some of you, in fact, you two gentlemen there, for instance, are scientists and have talked to me about their journeys and how difficult it has been as scientists to actually enter the world of religion. And I very much sympathise with that. But first, we'll talk about secularisation. Now, originally, secularisation was neutral toward religion. It wasn't hostile to it. If you read the studies in the secular society, and of course Charles Taylor's marvellous work, which Father Lawrence mentioned, A Secular Age, is of course one of the great texts. If you can work through that 500-page tome, which I actually have, and I was pleased I got to the end, frankly. But what happened in the course of time is the secular became secularism. And I would like to propose today that secular and secularism are different things. Secular simply means that the political and social world is to be kept apart from the church, and there's to be a so-called separation between church and state. Secularism is an ideology as distinct from secular, and secularism finds religion to be an embarrassment to the core ideas of the secular state. And those two ideas are progress, which involves science, of course, and human autonomy. Progress was interpreted as a departure from tradition and a movement away from the past. Excuse me. Human autonomy was narrowly interpreted as a celebration of the will and its freedom from spiritual forces. Any recognition of spiritual forces was depicted as and derided as superstition. And any appeal to God, spirit, or providence, for instance, was constructed by secularism as unmodern, anti-modern even. Thus, religion became, for secularism, the enemy of the state, as was the case in Marxist and communist nations. In capitalist systems, religion was not so much the enemy of the state as an encumbrance or an irrelevance. It was a bit of the past which still hung around, dinosaur-like. But the exception to the rule, of course, was the United States, which managed to find a way to, I would suggest, manipulate the religious spirit so that it supported capitalistic industry and commerce. The spirit of Protestantism, according to Max Weber. And in America, there was no perceived difference between progress, enterprise, and religiousness. But other cultures didn't manage to engage in that. But outside the United States, Western countries experienced religion as an anachronism that could be jettisoned. In Britain and Australia, which are very much alike, despite the Americanization of Australia, it's still very British. Religion degenerated into a kind of formalism or ceremony, having little spiritual vitality. In Western Europe, as it says on the overhead, the spiritual life tended to be shut down, forced underground. Churches declined and lost authority. Over the last 50 years, religious participation in Britain and Australia fell from 33%, I've got 35 on the overhead, but that's wrong, to a mere 7% at the moment. But in Germany, Holland and Italy, the percentages are between 1 and 2%. However, spirit can't be wholly expunged from humanity. Secularism would like to dispense with the spiritual, but of course it can't do so. The spiritual belongs to human nature, and its suppression leads not to its annihilation, but to its reappearance in other forms. And secularism led to what I would call the privatization of the sacred. And that's what we find in society today, and what is referred to as spirituality. Many are alienated from churches because they are products of the secular system that has devalued public worship and forced spiritual life into the human subject. This has weakened religion in the public sphere, but paradoxically intensified it in the private sphere. This is why we live in such puzzling times. An ancient Chinese curse says, "May you live in interesting times." And our times are certainly interesting in that special sense. So it's a paradoxical situation. As formal religions continue to decline, interest in spirituality is skyrocketing. This is happening in Britain especially. I've been following the work of David Hay and Kate Hunt, and they've been publishing in The Tablet quite a lot, "Is Britain's Soul Waking Up?" And then the bottom of the overhead, David Hay's book, "Something There, The Biology of the Human Spirit," which might be of interest to the scientists in our audience in particular. Now, religious people rightly complain that the new spirituality is too private and the community dimension is ignored. But modern individuals can't be blamed for this. They have been socialized this way. Many know no other world except one in which spirituality is by definition personal and not shared with anyone. This is simply what happens when religion goes into eclipse. However, secularism has unwittingly set the stage for its own demise, because by rejecting the spiritual, it ensured that this dynamic in human nature would return, as the repressed always returns, in inexplicable ways, and with a desire to undermine the structures that have driven it into exile. And the overhead, hence we are, as sociologists have announced, in a post-secular culture today, and the angry outbursts of fundamentalism are only one aspect of this return of the repressed. This afternoon I'll be talking to you about terrorism and fundamentalism as, I think, dangerous signs of the times, and with a focus on last week's crisis in France. Yes, that talk was written very quickly. Some of it on the plane. Now, there's a vast and growing literature on post-secular consciousness. There's some of it there. A book that I found particularly helpful is Harvey Cox, The Future of Faith, 2009. And if you're puzzling about where on earth we're all headed, I can strongly recommend that. The other one, which is by Pope Benedict and Jürgen Habermas, yes, even Pope Benedict got in on this particular debate with Habermas, called The Dialectics of Secularization, published in 2006. Fascinating book, and well worth reading. Now, the next question is the rise of science. Now, this question leads us to mysticism, and I'll explain why. Science has urged people not to accept anything handed down by tradition and accept only that which can be verified by experience or experiment. That is indeed the scientific method, which has been applied, as you know, to all fields of knowledge, and now it's being applied to the life of the spirit after, you know, the physical sciences, the natural sciences, biology, chemistry, physics, and so on, astrophysics. It's now being applied to the spirit. And this is why there's such disjunction between spirituality and what the popular people are calling religion. Modern people are unable to support religions unless they have had an experience that might validate their claims. This reverses the pattern of the past. I was talking to Father Lawrence on the bus yesterday about this. Previously, like when I was a boy, you were given religion. It was given you, as it were, from above by priestly and church authority. And I dutifully accepted that and respected that because I was a dutiful and respectful person. And the idea was that it would be passed on to you from, as it were, you know, the head, the catechism, and so on. And then if you were lucky, it would engage in what I call an 18-inch drop from the top of the head to the heart, and then you would become a spiritual person, not just a religious one where it's all in the head, but a spiritual person where you can feel it in the heart and it starts igniting your life from within. That was the world I grew up in. Head first, heart later, if you were lucky. But if you weren't lucky, you wouldn't experience a heart relation to religion at all, which is why when the 1960s came along, so many Catholics and Anglicans and other groupings and denominations got rid of their religiousness, because the age of Aquarius, the age of the 1960s, was very much opposed to religion. So in other words, if you hadn't engaged in a drop from the top of the head to the heart, that you were vulnerable to just throwing it out entirely and becoming atheistic or secular, or not even atheistic, just not caring enough to even worry about religion. But now it works in reverse, and I'd like to try and work on this more, because this is the future, and this is what Harvey Cox says in The Future of Faith. We have to start with the heart and then take it up to the head. Start with the heart, start with experience, which of course is what the world community of Christian meditation is all about. Start with the heart, have experiences, and then it trickles up almost against the force of gravity. And then, oh my God, that's what that means. Oh, that's what that means. So then you have sort of little epiphanies or revelations that help you sort of fill out what religious language is all about. But unless we start with the heart, young people, and I'll be talking about young people tomorrow, won't have a bar of religion at all. They just see it as absurd. It's almost farcical. A friend, let's call him a friend, said to me a couple of weeks ago, how are you going with your invisible friend? This is why I'm so pleased to be out of the university system. It's a form of persecution, you know. Oh, my invisible friend sitting on the end of the bed, and I'm saying hello to it, him, every morning. You know, a lot of people think of me as a believer as a lunatic. It's so incredible. It's so arrogant. Maybe I am a lunatic. I don't know. But this is the way the secular world makes us feel. Now, if I had the energy and strength, I would have taken that person, sit them down, and just, what are you attacking here? You know, what are you attacking? Because you often find that a lot of people who are atheists have very infantile images of God that they have to overcome, and there's no faith development that's gone on in their lives. I did a television show a couple of years ago. Some of you who are Australians might have seen it on the ABC. It was called Belief in God, and I was set up against two atheists. One was Philip Adams. You all know him, yeah. And he treated me like I had an invisible friend. Yeah. And I let him win the debate, actually, because atheists are clever and they want to win. You know, he's our Richard Dawkins, Lawrence, you know. And he really thinks he's far cleverer than me because I'm one of those poor old impoverished people who still labour under illusions. You know? And then he said, no, I don't need God. And then I asked him on TV what he thought about God. And it was a sort of a very infantile, kindergartenish. He said, oh, I don't believe there's an old man in the sky sitting on a cloud with a white beard. Duh. And I entered my first killing blow to the debate, which was, Philip, the God you don't believe in never did exist. So that's what we're up against. You know? People without any sense of faith development, they might have stopped their religious development when I was about 4 or 5 years old. And although Philip is, I'm 62 and he's 75, he still has the mental image of God as a 4 or 5 year old. So something in him has never been allowed to grow up. And he naturally looks upon me with, you know, deprecation and derision. So these are the debates that are happening at the moment. But the atheists are feeling nervous. Because there's a movement afoot. There's a movement afoot. And young people are rejecting the atheism of their parents. Philip said on camera, he said, I had 3 daughters. He said, one became a Jungian analyst. One actually converted to Judaism. And the third one became a convert to Christianity. And he said, where did I go wrong? And I said, where you've gone wrong is that you're contrary to the spirit of the time. That you're dishing out old-fashioned 1940s and 50s atheism to kids of the 21st century. They want something more now. And they deserve something more. And they will get something more by hook or by crook. Plus, all these atheist parents don't understand that kids have a right to rebel against parents. So just as my generation tended to rebel against the conventional religiousness of their parents, so the current generation, and the cycle repeats itself. So the question now is, watch this space. You know, it's a fascinating time that we live in. Now I want to talk a bit about the East. The East, I think, does mystical experience better than the West, with all due respect to everybody here. Which is why there is such widespread interest in Eastern pathways. Don't know about New Zealand, but in Australia, Buddhism is the fastest growing religion in the country. Yeah, it's faster growing even than Islam, despite the huge numbers of Islamic people coming to Australia. It's faster growing than even Pentecostalism. And the youth churches, the revivalist mega churches like Hillsong. Buddhism puts them all in the shade. And I want to think about this for the minute. The East, why is the East so popular? And what can we learn from the East? Of course, Father Lawrence has an ongoing connection with the Dalai Lama and other major figures in Eastern practices. The East places experience first and asks people to experiment with spiritual practices and draw conclusions based on their experience. This, I think, is the perfect formula for religious life in a postmodern, post-secular, and scientific world. You could almost say Buddhism is scientific in that regard. It's actually scientific. It's true to scientific principles, which is why Einstein famously declared that the future of religion is Buddhism in the 1930s. In my view, Western traditions won't regain their former attraction until they learn what the East has always known, that one has to start with the heart and work upwards, to use that metaphor I began before. The West has some good background in this, not perhaps in its exoteric institutions, you know, the churches in our cities and suburbs, but certainly in its monastic and mystical traditions. If the West wants to recapture the hearts of people, it will have to revive the monastic pathways and bring the monastery to the street. That's one of the slogans of my work now. And the Carmelites have got interested in this, and I'm doing a lot of work with the Carmelites in Australia at the moment. Bring the monastery to the street, because people are hungry for the kinds of spiritual exercises that were known in our Christian esoteric traditions. The only kind of religion that will meet the needs of post-modernity and the post-secular will be mystical and existential. And my prophecy or prediction is anything else and everything else will be rejected. It's a harsh thing to say, but unless it's mystical and existential, people won't be interested. Now, according to some accounts, if only between 1 and 7% of some Western populations are engaged in religious participation, this is on the overhead, up to 75%, this doesn't surprise me based on my experience at the university, are interested in and actively pursue spiritual experiences. The question now becomes, this is beautifully documented in this book by Robert Foreman, who's a New York sociologist, called Grassroots Spirituality. And he differentiates, as I will in a minute, between grassroots spirituality and the New Age spirituality movement, because the two are often fused and connected. Today, it's become common for people to say they are spiritual but not religious. Whereas this would have been unheard of a century ago. And the acronym has emerged, SBNR, people say to each other. This is code language. Spiritual but not religious. Is widely used. I've been looking up social network sites, not because I want a date, but because I'm finding this term used all over the place. It's fascinating. It's a social phenomenon. In an historical sense, the term spirituality has undergone a reversal. It once referred to those who were very religious, and now it apparently refers to those who are not very religious. So spirituality has expanded as a term, whereas religion has contracted. Religion was once the great circle inside which spirituality was a smaller circle. Now spirituality is the greater circle and religion has become circles inside the wider sphere of spirituality. This is why I mean by the curse of the Chinese, may you live in interesting times. No wonder many people are confused, because we've got our circles all mixed up. And we're going round in circles, trying to understand what it is about today that is so perplexing. We have our celebrity atheists, Richard Dawkins, which I had to read because my students asked me to. I didn't want to read it. And I thought, well, look, he's an evolutionary biologist who's writing a book on God. Now, as a God person, if I wrote a book on evolutionary biology, it would be regarded as total crap by everybody, including me. Why is it that an evolutionary biologist can suddenly become an authority on God and misunderstand God? But the book I love best is the one written in Boston recently called The Dawkins Delusion, which is a very good answer to this book. The book is worth reading because it's the mainstream view at the moment, that God is an imaginary friend at the end of your bed. It's a delusion of religious folk, and it's a delusion that they have to get over in order to grow up and become mature and independent, etc. Now, Christopher Hitchens is another major one. God is not great. How religion poisons everything. Christopher Hitchens, after venting his spleen on God, upped and died. And it reminded me of a bumper sticker I saw in Melbourne recently. I was in a traffic, and the first part of the bumper sticker said, "God is dead, - Nietzsche." And underneath it said, "Nietzsche is dead, God." So God is coming back, even on bumper stickers. Now, religious institutions often look askance at this new spiritual revolution, as it's been called. Paul Helas and Linda Woodhead in the UK have written a wonderful book. I disagree with every word of it, but it's still worth reading. Called The Spiritual Revolution: Why Religion is Giving Way to Spirituality. These are typical academics in the British academic system. They dislike religion, and they're really giving it that extra shove over the edge of the abyss. And I don't like the book, but it's a typical perception about what's happening at the moment. The reason I don't like it is because they have such a narrow definition of religion. As I'll say toward the end of this talk, religion is spirituality. That's what it is. And this dualism between them is, of course, to some extent, a phony and a fake one. Now, the secular and the religious establishments tend to conflate two movements, the New Age and the grassroots spirituality, which we see popping up in our own children, in our grandchildren, in our university students, and all over the place. And the New Age movement, I'm sometimes referred to as a New Ager, which just goes to show how little people know about me. I'm not a New Ager at all. If anything, I'm in the Christian mystical tradition, but because people associate spirituality now with the New Age, it gets packaged. Every time you mention spirituality in the wider community, people think New Age. The New Age, as I said, deserves the criticism it gets. It's superficial, it's unhistorical, it's exploitative, and full of promises that it can't deliver. It's a consumerist movement which packages and sells cosmologies often stolen from indigenous cultures such as Maori, Aboriginal, and of course most common of all, American Indian traditions, and sells these to the starving masses. The New Age exists, I would say, because the religions are not doing their job properly, frankly. The fact that there is a New Age is because the religions have lost connection with their spirituality, and that the religions are as yet unable to respond to this desire to start from the heart. Instead, when you go into churches, perhaps not so much me, my generation, because I understand the garments worn by Christianity. I respect those garments. I understand the language of the Mass, the creeds. But if I was, instead of being 62, if I was 15, I would walk in off the street and it wouldn't make any sense to me at all. And as a result, the young people are rejecting it because it's like gobbledygook. It's a language they don't understand. What the New Age is the consumerist shopfront of free-floating spirituality. It's the shopfront. And what is behind that facade is much more important than the facade itself. Now, the secular, I find, those who are part of secularism, an ideology, want to discredit all forms of spiritual activity, and they don't look closely enough to see what's going on to make any distinctions between grassroots spirituality and the New Age. Now, the religious tend to regard the spirituality movement in a similar way, in a jaundiced fashion, as a competitor for souls, and are too willing to discredit what is perceived as a rival force. This is a funny situation where the secular left, particularly strong in our universities, and the religious right, particularly strong in our church hierarchies, both dislike uncontained spirituality, but for opposite reasons. The secular left dislike it because they want the world to become more and more secular, and they think that spirituality is an illusion, according to Freud, in his book The Future of an Illusion, written in 1927. And of course, Freud's illusion became Dawkins' delusion in 2006, almost 100 years later. The religious right don't want uncontained spirituality because it does not put bums on church seats. And therefore, why should it be interested in the fact that, as I said a minute ago, 75% are possibly interested in and actively pursue spiritual experiences in, as the Anglican bishop said, our so-called secular society. I've written a book on this called Jung and the New Age. It was published in London and New York in 2001. And so I don't want to go on further about it at this stage. I've already written a whole book on it. And I've dealt with that one as well. So in my view, we are in the midst of a genuine spiritual revival, and I've monitored this for a number of years at my university. And I published a book actually before the other one. I accused them of pinching my title, The Spirituality Revolution, but they said they'd come up with it completely independently. The Emergence of Contemporary Spirituality, which was published in Sydney in 2003 and came out in London, New York in 2004. One of the things to say about the spirituality revolution is that it gets a lot of positive hype, particularly from young people, but that under the hype, they're actually, a lot of them are lost. And one of the reasons they're lost is because, of course, they have no roots, no ancestral background, no rich, loamy soil in which to grow their spirituality plant. A religious colleague of mine said, spirituality is like cut flowers. They're beautiful in a vase for a week, maybe 2 weeks, but they won't grow. They'll wilt and fade because they have no roots. And the roots, really, is tradition. Tradition are the roots. And without traditions, a lot of the spirituality that a lot of young people sing praises about will actually fade like flowers in a vase. It needs something more. But what they are experiencing, I think, is legitimate. It's not just a New Age fantasy. It's the actual return of the spirit in a secular age. So having described the separation of spirituality and religion, I do not believe that this situation is permanent or irredeemable. I think spirituality and religion can come back together again, and I think the World Christian Meditation, Christian Community of Meditation, is part of this, very much at the forefront of this reconciliation of these two separating continents of religion and spirituality, which is why I was so pleased to get this invitation from Father Lawrence to speak here, because I feel this is one of the really key positive signs about where we have to move. Spirituality and religion can come back together again. Now, I want to now explore this. as long as both are prepared to change. It's not going to happen on the terms of religions. It's not going to happen on the terms of popular spirituality either. One thing that has to change is that popular or grassroots spirituality, which, as I've said, is possibly up to 75% of the population, has to give up its penchant for private experience and recognise it has a responsibility to all humanity and not only to one human life. This is the big problem that it faces. Moreover, it not only has a moral responsibility to community, but I would say its own satisfaction is realised only when the larger dimensions of spirituality are perceived. And here I quote my dear friend, now passed on, unfortunately, from this life, Father John O'Donoghue from Ireland. He says this: although each soul is individual and unique, by its very nature, the soul hungers for relationship. No soul is private. As well as being the vital principle of your individual life, your soul is ancient and eternal. It weaves you into the great tapestry of spirit which connects everything everywhere. That's from his book Eternal Echoes, written as a follow-up from his runaway bestseller, as publishers like to say, Anamkara, which some of you will have read. He came down here to Australia, New Zealand a couple of times, and then all of a sudden he died from a brain aneurysm in France, and I was, like a lot of people, completely cut up over this, because I thought that he was one of the people who was really at the had his finger on the pulse, as it were. So what O'Donoghue's saying here is that spirituality can never reach its fulfilment in social isolation. Spirit longs to be shared and communicated. Indeed, if it doesn't long to be shared and communicated, you might say it isn't spirit at all. It's something else. It's a more than personal force requiring a more than personal goal. And this is another way of saying, perhaps in more religious and old-fashioned language, that spirit calls us to love. And love can't be experienced by one person in isolation. So individualism and spirituality are antithetical. And the sooner the new grassroots spirituality realises this, the sooner we will knit together the worlds of tradition and experience. But religion too must change. Indeed, if it doesn't change, it will die. That's the name of a book, actually, by Bishop John Spong, Christianity Must Change or Die. I have a sort of ambivalent relationship with Spong. I sometimes like him and sometimes dislike him. But I think his best book is Jesus for the Non-Religious. Jesus for the Non-Religious is, I think, an outstanding contribution to the muddle that we're in at the moment. Now, what I think religion needs to understand, which it hasn't yet fully understood, especially the hierarchies, is that the era of belief is over. People can't believe anymore. And that religion must stop asking people to believe. Instead, the considerable resources of the religions, I should speak about them in the plural, should be spent on helping people attain personal experiences of faith. This means accepting that the interior self is not only marked and impacted by original sin, but that it's also characterised by original blessing. Now, as you know, there's been a debate raging in the Catholic Church in recent years about, are we original sinners or do we have original blessing? Now, I can't see why we have to opt for one or the other, frankly. And this is where my conservatism comes out, because when I was officially banned by the Catholic Church in the 1990s, and I'll talk to you about that later, all the radical priests came out of the woodwork and said, let's form a united front against those bad guys at the top, you know. I thought, no, I'm not interested in that. I don't want to engage in some silly, phony war. Plus, they're on my side. They both want the same thing, except going about it differently. And it seems that the so-called progressive Christian thinkers are all for original blessing, and suddenly the traditional Christian thinkers are being lumped with original sin. But I want both, because that's what the Bible gives us. It gives us original sin, the fall. You can't dismiss that story. You can't just say, oh, in the New Age, we don't believe in that anymore. It's part of our tradition. But so is original blessing, part of our tradition. And so I think what I like, and again, about the World Community for Christian Meditation, is that it understands that there's an interior dimension to religion, which has been lacking in tradition. And one of the reasons it's been lacking is because traditional authorities have often felt that the self is worthless because it's entirely sinful. And therefore, if we want to be saved, we have to somehow miraculously overcome the self and make our appeals through the church and the clergy direct to God and avoid our own interiority entirely. But that's not what the mystical traditions say. The mystical traditions, which I said before is the tradition that I identify with, understands that there is an interior way in. I call it the back door into God. There's an interior way in, a way through the heart. Start with the heart. And that's because the self has an inner dimension. I'm working on a paper at the moment for another conference for the Carmelites, because this year is the 500th anniversary of the birth of Teresa of Avila. And, of course, her masterpiece, The Interior Castle, is one of the great works of spiritual literature. I can commend it to all of you to read. And what she shows in The Interior Castle is that there's a potential for grace at the interior level. This doesn't mean, a lot of people say, oh yes, but what about social justice? What about the church in the world? Well, the answer is Richard Rohr's centre in America. It's the Centre for Action and Contemplation. Not one or the other. And this is, again, I refuse to make an either-or distinction between grace on the one hand and sin on the other. I accept that I am sinful and I accept that I'm potentially graced. And I only say that with great humility. But also I think that when we make contact with the divine, we have an obligation toward our inner selves to find God in our interiority. And we also have an obligation to social justice. So that's why I like that idea of the Centre for Action and Contemplation. Maybe I'll set one up in my retirement. Don't know. Now, Yeats, Father Lawrence was quoting Yeats this week, and I will join him. Yeats says, "Now that my ladder's gone, I must begin where all the ladders start, in the foul rag and bone shop of the heart." Isn't that beautiful? That's where we're at the moment. If people want to know where we're at, we're in the rag and bone shop of the heart. That's why it's such a difficult time for a lot of conservative Christians. And I sympathise with them, actually, because I have a strongly conservative Christian side myself that says, I don't want to deal with the rag and bone shop of the heart. I want to fast forward through that and go straight to the transcendent. But we can't anymore. The ladder's gone. That simple sort of... And it's gone by science. It's got rid of it. And, of course, secularisation, these two big factors that I'm talking about today. Now, Father Lawrence, I'm sure you met William Johnston. And I was lucky enough to meet him at a conference in Sydney, and I've always found him a deeply inspiring thinker, and I think what he's said is very much about where we're at the moment. Now, as it says on the overhead, he spent decades studying Zen Buddhism, but importantly, not becoming a Zen Buddhist. He remained a Jesuit. and finding parallels with Western tradition, he believed that the Christian prejudice against the mystical needs to be overcome. William Johnson said, quote, this is William Johnson, one of my daughters did this for me, and I said to her, Haley, this is terrific work, but you've left the quotation marks off. And she said, oh, it's too late now, you've got to go to the airport. And I said, well, I'll have to explain to them in Hamilton that the quotation marks are missing. And she said, I'm sure they can handle it. So thanks to Haley, because I can't do PowerPoints because I'm too old or something. William Johnson said, today we are face to face with a new world that is attracted by mysticism and impatient of irrelevant and wordy speculation. Now we are entering into dialogue with the mystical religions of Asia. In these circumstances, a revival of Christian mysticism will certainly come. Isn't that beautiful? Bring it on. Indeed, it's already with us, says William Johnston. Will the much neglected mystical theology become the centre of all theology? Surely this is the way forward for the future. End quote. Now, the most insightful mystics in recent times, and I've had sort of binges on all of these. I had my Thomas Merton binge and my B. Griffiths binge, which is where I met Andrew Harvey, of course, in that culture, and my William Johnson binge. Now I'm having a Lawrence Freeman binge. These people have spent much of their lives trying to understand Eastern mysticism and why it exerted such a mesmerising influence on Westerners. Each of them, Johnston, B. Griffiths and Merton, realised that Western religion was in crisis of relevance and the East could provide help in recovering the interior dimension of religious life. Now, Western-East ought not be seen as competing with each other. Both are trying to access the same reality, but from different sides. It's simply that the West took the extroverted route, the presence of God in history, revelation and tradition, and the action side, charity, social justice, community service, whereas the East took the introverted route, the presence of God in interiority, in experience, in subjectivity, and in consciousness. Now, the poem says, the old poem saying says, East is East and West is West and never the twain shall meet. Well, I hope that's not true. And recently I was at a big, enormous gathering in Melbourne with the Dalai Lama. It was the Rod Laver Arena, which seats about, 40 or 50,000 people. And it was packed. And one of the first things the Dalai Lama said, which I thought was really moving, was, a lot of you, he says, are from the Christian and Jewish traditions, and I do not want to make you converts to Buddhism. And I thought, wow. Imagine how different it would be if that was a Christian speaker and there were 50,000 people there, he'd want to make every one of them a convert. How gracious the East is. How generous they are. And what he went on to say was, I want to make you better Christians and better Jews by linking you with your interiority. And I just thought, praise the Lord. You know, no wonder people are going to the Dalai Lama. You know, not only does he have the gift and the language and the exercises to engage us in interiority, but he also has the gracious goodwill to realise that the aim of the West is not to uproot ourselves from the roots and become flowers in a vase which wilt overnight, but to reconnect us with our traditions, which I've been trying to do. One of my binges was on Ireland. I used to go to Ireland every year, and people would say, what are you here for? Is there a conference or is there a university? I said, no, I'm not interested in universities or conferences. I just want to soak up the land. And I look at people in Ireland and they look like my own parents and grandparents, my parents and grandparents are all dead, and I go and see their images in people in Ireland, and I just feel very much at home, as well as trying to deal with, of course, the connection with indigenous cultures in my new world. So I can understand why people are moving to the East. And when I heard that from the Dalai Lama, I thought this is absolutely magnificent and very generous. Now, naturally, like all of us here, probably I've been influenced by Karl Rahner, the great Jesuit theologian, who was such an influence in the Vatican II era. He made a comment. He said, the future Christian will be a mystic, or he, and I add, or she, will not exist at all. What a tall order that seems. When I first read this, I thought of my own parish community and how, not to be too judgmental, but a lot of people in my parish are on automatic pilot, actually. They're going to Mass because they fear damnation after life, and they're building up credit, in a sense. And it's a pity that a lot of us Catholics, and I'm sorry, Anglicans, I'm not sure what your problems are, but probably similar, do have this weight, right? Very similar? Very similar. So I thought this was a tall order of Karl Rahner, and couldn't imagine ordinary folk becoming mystics in order to achieve faith. But knowing as I do the obstacles to faith today and the impossibility of belief, faith and belief are different. I'll be going into that later, tomorrow. I now agree that unless people struggle to find an authentic personal connection, they might never achieve faith at all. And in this same essay, Rahner added, by mysticism we mean a genuine experience of God emerging from the very heart, note that word again, of our experience. So Rahner was onto this as well. And the spirit of Vatican II is very much, still something that is very reliable and trustworthy. So finally, I think that's in an essay called The Spirituality of the Church of the Future. So I come back to Sandra Snyder's question, spirituality and religion, in closing now. Are they strangers, rivals, or partners? And I've tried to sketch out how they're all those things, actually. It's not either or. They are, for my children. I mean, my children have gone to Catholic school, but I'm not so sure how Catholic they actually are. Or maybe they are Catholic and I can't see it. Or they don't want to let on or whatever. But anyway... Spirituality offers, as I've been saying, personal experience of the numinous. Now, what does numinous mean? It's a Latin word. It comes from the word numen, meaning the power of a god, the power of a deity. And it's what I think Indigenous people in all cultures, not just New Zealand and Australia, but all Indigenous people, have a sense of the numinous in the natural world, which is what my talk was about last night. Secondly, spirituality offers an apprehension of the mystical dimension of experience, particularly accessed and understood through meditation and contemplation and prayer, for those of us who are able to understand what prayer is. And thirdly, an intuitive feeling-based access to the very ideas on which religion is based. And they're, I think, the three offerings of spirituality. Religion offers a common language to describe spiritual experience, so we're not all wandering around with our own private bag of spirituality, unable to communicate with each other. It offers a social context and, of course, the possibility of community, which is in short supply in the postmodern world. It offers, of course, an historical background and the possibility of the present speaking to the past. And I should have added too, it offers the possibility of the past speaking to the present. You know, those moments where you read scripture or you read something from Augustine or Meister Eckhart, or, and you think, my God, this is speaking directly to me. You know, it speaks directly to the present. So spirituality without religion is spirit without form, and that's what we have in mainstream society today, spirit without form. And religion without spirituality, alas, we have too much of that, is form without substance. So I just wanted to leave you, I think that's my last overhead, yes, with that, and I'm happy to take questions or comments. Thank you very much for your attention.
You can hear more talks and conversations in the media section on our website, wccm.org, or in your favorite podcast player. Thanks for listening. For WCCN, I am Elba Rodriguez.